Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we have a lot of celebrating coming up, don't we?
We do. We probably should have said good evening for this program.
Right. We've got Easter, we've got Passover, we've got things to drink, lots of things to drink.
All in liquid format today. So we've been collecting for recommendations. For those of you who support Passover, those of you who celebrate Passover, those of you who celebrate Easter, and those of you who celebrate generally. So that's what we've been doing. And curiously enough, our first guest talks about a wine called Zia Bafa. And you're going to have to listen closely to understand why that happened. And it was actually first introduced to us as a surprise for Valentine's Day. But somehow it stayed on the shelf until we had time to say, you know what, this wine would be great at Easter too and at Passover as well. So a very unique story of a person with a unique interest in surfing as well as wine. Who became fascinated by the product called Zia Bafa, and who wanted the wine to be how do you describe it? Oh so natural, oh so organic, oh so pure. So their work extended even to the quality of the cork, and it's rather unusual mating with the bottle. All kinds of fascinating things we never even thought to ask about a wine before. So listen carefully. Well, this track is going to be interesting because it's a story within a story. Welcome Kevin Swedish from San Diego, California, right?
And Sage Beverages.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your company first, and then let's go into the story that really brought this to our attention.
We import beer, wine, and tequila from around the world. The company was first founded by a brand called Lucky Buddha, which we have now taken across the entire United States. We're distributed in all 50 states, and we have had the great fortune of being in the who's who of the retail trade across the U.S. And one of the things that we just looked at along that journey was there's opportunities to bring other brands into the marketplace. And it was really my theory was that there was a great opportunity for brands to go into the distribution cycle, but there was also a need to have brands that were somewhat innovative and unique and could tell a story. One of the things that we say at Sage Beverages is every one of our brands tells a story, and certainly we're speaking today about Zia Bafa, and there is a lot of stories within the wines of Zia Bafa themselves.
Well, let's first of all have you tell the story of how Zia Bafa got its name and how it came to happen. And then we want to talk about some of the innovations that Zia Bafa represents. But the thing that caught our attention was the story, because Zia stands for uncle, and somebody, and we actually thought for a while it was you, actually was christened Uncle Bafa, or Zia Bafa, when he was in Italy for an entirely different reason. So give us the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say.
So my business partner went to high school with Jason Bafa, and I received a call late on a Saturday, just about a year ago, stating that Jason was going to be in San Diego with Pier Giorgio Castellani, and I was very familiar with Castellano Winery, and they were looking to do a collaboration on a wine and would like my input on it. So I told my wife that I was going to be gone for about an hour or so. I was meeting him at a Starbucks in Cardiff, and that I'd give her a shout when the meeting was over. Well, as I started to talk to Jason and then Pier Giorgio, I just got fascinated by what this journey looked like. Jason was a heralded surf documentarian, and he has had many films that have had an amazing following, like One California Day, Single Fin, etc. And Jason chronicled the journey of a professional surfer named Chris Del Moro, whose ancestry was half Italian. And Chris Del Moro is an artist, an environmentalist, and a pro surfer. And he wanted to go back to Italy and retrace his Italian heritage and his roots and his passion for food, his passion for the environment, and his passion for surfing. And they discovered several things. They discovered there was a vibrant surf culture and scene in Italy. And they also joined forces with Pier Giorgio Castellani on the making of the Zia Bafa wines. And to your point about the term Zio, and Jason was lovingly referred to as uncle, which in Italian is Zio. and Baffa is his last name, and that just became what the locals were calling him during the entire filming. And hence the name Zio Baffa became a natural for the naming of the wine.
But at this point, they were still filming about surfing.
They were. And it also coincided with the harvest, and so this became the filmmaker's edition. So the wines were literally harvested while the movie was being produced. And when I first had the meeting with them, I had not even had a chance to try the wine.
Where in Italy is this taking place?
Tuscany.
Okay. East Coast, West Coast? What?
Well, there's only one coast in Tuscany, which is east. Which is west.
West. It's west.
But one of the wines doesn't come from Tuscany. If I was reading the label correctly, it actually comes from Puglia, which does have a coast on the east. So
the white wine, the Pinot Grigio, does come from Puglia.
It does, okay. From a particular place there? Or?
It comes from Pier Giorgio's vineyards in the south of Italy. And the other thing that just intrigued me about the wines, and I'm probably slightly getting ahead of what you'd like to ask me, but at this meeting I also discovered that the wines were totally aligned with what we were doing here at Sage Beverages. And all of our brands literally have an ethos that talks about the environment.
Okay.
And the wines were organic, biodynamic, and they're also non-GMO certified, which has also become a big deal for us.
Great. Now, are they actually estate grapes that go into the wines?
Yes.
Okay. So the Castellano, the gentleman whose name you pronounced so quickly, he has properties in both Tuscany and in Puglia.
Yes, he does.
Okay. And they had been making the wines already?
They had been making... Castellani Winery does about 3 million cases a year.
Okay, right.
And it's sold in 40 countries around the world.
Wow.
So it's like Fresco Baldi or somewhere like that, is it?
Exactly. It's a big or Antinori. Additionally, he's fifth generation. The estate's over 111 years old.
Wow.
Now, here's one for you. We just drank a wine that was produced by the descendants of Dante Alighieri. In the Lombardy region of Italy, where he moved after they threw him out of Florence in the 14th century. So five generations is not a lot, but it certainly is when compared to California.
Yes, very true.
Now, the wineries are using organic and biodynamic practices.
They are. And the other thing that's very relevant to me, living in California, and certainly the drought has had major ramifications here, is the vineyards are also dry farmed. So consequently, when we looked at everything about the project, from the glass being incredibly recyclable, that the cork allowed the bottles to be used several times because it was...
Let's come back to the closure in just a minute or two, because I think that's a story in its own right. But right now we're just dealing with the romance of the wines themselves.
Well, just to carry through, the other part of the sustainability that I liked, the shipping case is made from recycled cardboard. All the inks and glues are zero emission. So everything just was aligned with what I was looking for within our own company as the type of brands we represent.
Do you do the same stringent sustainability standards with your tequila brands?
So as an example, my tequila bottle is made from recycled car windshields.
Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah. All right. So continue along with the eco-friendly Zio Baffa wines.
So at the conclusion of the meeting, and frankly, it probably took closer to 4 hours, my wife kept calling me and says, "What's going on?" I said, this is a long story, and I can't tell it to you in a five-minute soundbite, so let me tell you when I get home. We decided that we were going to launch Zio Baffa in the U.S. literally 6 months after that meeting. And so there's other things that just had to occur before we were able to do that. One, the winery was sending me samples to see what the wine should taste like, and Pier Giorgio just did a masterful job in blending both the Pinot Grigio and the Toscano. First starting with the Pinot Grigio, one of the things that we've been getting a great deal of wonderful feedback is what an amazing aroma the wine has. And he was able to blend just a little bit of Johannesburg Riesling with the Pinot Grigio and allowed this crisp nose that just, before you even drink the wine, it just comes alive. And then with the Toscano, he added a little Syrah to the Sangiovese blend and just put a little more, as I call, meat on the bones. So the wine has the ability to stand up to great Italian cuisine, or frankly any cuisine for that matter, and also is very drinkable just by itself. So he just created this wonderful product that also was allowing us to tell additionally all the other parts of the stories that we were just talking about.
So the Toscano is like, it's sort of like a mini Super Tuscan.
It is. As you know, Super Tuscans typically have Cabernet as a blend, but we're using Sangiovese, but that's a great analogy.
But you've got some Syrah in there to give it extra body.
Exactly.
Now, what part of Toscana? We know Tuscany rather well, but you know what particular area does this come from?
It comes from about 20 miles northeast of Tuscany.
Northeast of what? Northeast of a particular city, or
northeast of Florence?
Yes.
And tell me how you would describe it. I know how I describe it, but I'm interested in comparing what my description is to what your description would be.
Of the wine?
Yes.
Well, I'm a big fan of the wines of Tuscany, and I've always been a big fan, especially of the Sangiovese grape. And to me, one of the things that he's been able to do is just make the wines more round and have this great mouthfeel to them. And that's a real art. That's a real talent.
One of the things it reminds me of is a Marolino di Scansano, which is a very coastal representation of the Sangiovese grapes, as opposed to the Rosso di Montalcino or the Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, which it seems to me are much stronger, sometimes not as approachable.
I think your description is exactly right. These wines are incredibly approachable.
Yeah, Peter, we had the Toscana red.
I'm not sure that I would have chosen to have it with a steak, but it worked.
That's what we had. Yeah.
It worked extremely well, and it also gave us a good excuse to drink it before we talked to you, which is kind of important. And we had the Pinot Grigio with Turbo the day before. We had a lot of catching up to do, and we did very well, I think. Now
did you have the 13 or 14 Pinot Grigio?
It was a 13, I think.
So the 14 is just now being released on these
coasts. Right.
And as wonderful as the 13 is, the 14 is even more spectacular. So I need to make sure I get you some.
Yeah, and I think the Toscano was a 2012. I think
that's correct. That's still the vintage we're in.
Great. Well, we'll certainly look forward to sampling the 14, if you think it's better. We're always interested in better. But let's go back
to this cork, because I'm the one that breaks all the screw pulls, getting them stuck in synthetic corks.
Yeah, this is most interesting, because a lot of, shall we say, you know, less expensive or middle market Italian wines have resorted in the plastic corks, especially the blue ones. And the blue ones have destroyed two of the screw pulls that I own.
The top of the line screw pulls too.
And because they just don't yield, and that certainly cannot be said for the helix, as you call the closure that's in the bottlings of the Zia Baffa wine. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I think that as an industry, we've struggled with the evolution of closures between tainted corks and corks breaking, and at the same time, having new innovations like the screw cap or synthetic corks, and there's never been what, from my point of view, has been the better mousetrap, and I firmly believe the Helix cork has accomplished that, in that you still have the romance of the cork without the taint. You still have the ease of opening. And I know in our house, many, many times, we might be in the mood for one more glass of wine and just don't want to open up a whole bottle. And so this allows customers to do that. Simply open, screw it back down. So a real ease for restaurateurs.
Now, what's the keeping quality like?
You know, we typically say 2 to 3 days.
Okay, so it's not like one of those little pump things where you pump the air out or anything like that.
It's not like a vacuum bin. What we really want to do is just appeal to people who enjoy wine, want to have the ease of opening, the ease of closure, and the wines certainly perform nicely for another couple 3 days.
Now, there's been some invention behind this process related to the bottle rather than the cork. Tell us a little bit about that aspect of it.
It was a joint venture between Owen Illinois, which is one of the world's largest glass producers, and Omen, which is a very, I believe they're a 100-year-old cork producer out of Portugal. And they came together to figure out the best way to create innovation in the wine space.
Yeah, something's very important to Portugal as a country, right? Because this is one of their big exports.
And certainly, I think to both companies. I mean, Owen Illinois is watching more and more of their business going to other markets as people are trying to source glass at a more affordable rate. And I think there's no question that Portugal has struggled with either shortages of corks or increased wine bottles with some taint on the corks. And watching more producers going to synthetic or screw caps. And so this became a great marriage.
So you said that, in fact, Owens, Illinois develop some kind of groove system inside the neck of the bottle.
So if you were to look through the neck or the opening into the neck, you would see external grooves inside the bottle.
Okay, so they stand out, the grooves, they're the opposite of grooves there, if you like. They stick out rather than being grooved in.
Well, you know what? I've been saying grooves for a year now, but you're exactly right. Okay. So they're not a groove. They are an external raise in the bottle.
Got it. And now, is the cork actually made from a solid piece of wood, or is it pressurized cork fragments?
It's pressurized fragments.
I figured it would have to be, because listeners, if you can imagine opening a conventionally corked bottle, pull it out with your corkscrew, immediately the part that was inside the bottle expands, and if you want to plug the cork back in again, you have to use the end that was on the outside of the bottle.
That's exactly right. So the cork is manufactured from pieces of cork that was grown under the guidance of the Forest Stewardship Council, and it eliminates what has been a problem of corks being bad. It also allows people to open a bottle without looking for a corkscrew. It also prevents corks from being broken, and as I mentioned earlier, allows you to reseal your bottle of wine for a couple of days.
Well, this is I want to return, however, to the romance of everything. Because of the way the calendar goes, most likely this interview is going to play on the 15th of February rather than the 14th. But it actually reached us to begin with a message that said this was just the thing for Valentine's Day. So is there another part of the Zio Bafa story that you left out? Did Zio Bafa marry his childhood sweetheart from a small town in Italy, or did something like that happen, or is it just now a commercial story of how to exploit these wines that you've discovered and brought into the United States?
Well, I would say that the love affair, if you will, and Valentine's Day being obviously a holiday where we celebrate love, was the love that happened with the journey back to Italy and rediscovering your Italian roots, rediscovering the love of your heritage, rediscovering the love of the culture, certainly having your friends and family around you as you are developing this wine. And also Chris in particular and Jason in particular have a love of the ocean and love of everything that is representative of surfing. For us, one of the things that people have said to me very early on, because we have had some exposure already on national TV. We were recently on Mario Batali's show, The Chew.
Oh, yeah? Uh-huh.
We were on the CBS show, Talk. And most recently, we were just on The Doctors, who were talking about the benefits of organic wines and how it increases antioxidants.
Oh, wow.
There you go. And now you've been on the famous worldwide website and internet broadcast On the Menu. Boy, you're touching everywhere. You're touching all the right places.
But we also feel that many times, particularly men and women, will use Valentine's Day as an opportunity to use an expression of cooking as part of their love. And I can tell you personally how many times I've actually struggled with a bottle of wine as I've worked very diligently to try and make a special meal for my wife. And we just thought, look, there's a whole story here about this wine and why it touches people at so many levels. Because for me, as someone who is bringing wine to the marketplace, it's doing it in a way that is different from most people currently because of all the various aspects that it has. As you say, it's a story in itself. The cork itself is revolutionary. And when you add up all the other elements of it, including the movie, it just makes a very wonderful, wonderful discussion.
Well, thank you so much for bringing it on the menus, listeners. Kevin, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. We hope your weather in San Diego is considerably better than it is here in the frozen north of Pittsburgh. And hopefully at some point in the future our paths will cross. And in the meantime, we'll get ready to raise a glass of 2014 Pinot Grigio Zio Bafa. Zio Bafa.
It was my pleasure, and I'm in Pittsburgh a great deal. I love your city.
Oh, really?
I look forward to meeting you guys in person.
Absolutely. Well, you must be sure to let us know when you're coming into town, and we'll take care of it with something nice to eat.
Sounds like you have that covered, so I look forward to it.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, well, Peter has been following these wines, and I'm going to let him explain them to you. He's following all the tasting notes, and he knows what he's talking about. The wines
well,
came.
Some people say that anyway.
The wines came from our good buds at Colangelo, and so Peter will give you a rundown on what these are. They're all red, aren't they?
They're all red as suitable to go with lamb.
Which is great.
And that's sort of the idea.
Because that's what we always have for
lots
Easter.
Lots and lots of people have lamb for Easter, including ourselves. Three wines.
Like a whole spit roasted lamb.
Yeah, there you go. Well, one of those is called for in the wine notes. Our good friends from the wonderful family of Frescobaldi.
Oh yes.
And enter first. With a new version of a wine produced at the Castello di Nipozzano, where we've actually visited.
Elegant place.
We had lunch there. We brought some wine back with us from there
elegant
as well.
Elegant lunch.
but they have a new representation of their wine called Vecchia Viti. And this is a new version of a 100% Sangiovese-based wine coming from to particularly unique vines in a particularly unique and beautiful winery with a castle in the middle of it. And the 2011 Nipozzano Vecchi Viti is a wine you should be looking out for, especially if you're fond of representations of the Sangiovese, because this promises to be different and very interesting. One of Italy's premier wine regions, the region of Barolo in the Piemonte, is an area we haven't been to for some time. In fact, we need to go back. But fortunately, Colangelo brought some of Barolo to us with a family vineyard founded in 1890 in the shadows of the castle that's in the center of the small town of Barolo. 100% Nebbiolo, of course, which it needs to be. And 2007 Barolo. Great if you like your wines full-bodied,
which I do.
Which we do. But if you like your wines light and fruity, this is not for you. But Barolo DOCG La Sac Vigne, standing for the five vineyards, which the Damilano family own in the vicinity of Barolo.
Why is
town
it
of Barolo.
French?
I don't know. They just decided to call it that.
Okay.
I don't know why. I'm sure it's somewhere in the tasting notes, in the details that I don't have in front of me. And of course, no Easter can be complete. No tasting of red wines from Italy can be complete without an entry from probably our 100% favorite winemaker, Marco Caprai.
Oh, he's
from
so
from Arnaldo Caprai. So
and he's fun. Oh, yes.
Yeah,
so they've
conjured up yet another representation of 100% Sagrantino. Only 80,000 bottles produced, so you better have your spies out trying to figure out where you can get some. The vintage that we have is 2009, I think. We're anticipating that this is going to live up to the same quality as the 25th anniversary wines, which we've been drinking for the last several years, and which we last drank a bottle of on a very important day. It was our wedding anniversary.
Which one?
And I bought a bottle. too many to count, but it was a special wine treat.
You don't remember, do you?
I can calculate it very easily, but I don't know that our listeners really need to know. But they do need to know that Peter is thoughtful and always remembers Anne's favorite wines and favorite foods and produces them on occasions like this. And we feel sure that this wine made in the shadow of the beautiful medieval city of Montefalco will live up to the reputation that Arnaldo Capri has gained in only 25 years, or just a little over 25 years. It's really amazing that that Marco's father founded the property just about less than 30 years ago, and Marco took over running it. And we've, of course, had the opportunity to visit with him in person.
And didn't we have fun?
Didn't we have fun?
I don't think I've ever had that much to eat
We'd love to go back, but we can play as if we're there by drinking this wine. And I'm guessing that that's the one that's going to finish up on our Easter table. And it should probably finish up on yours. So let's recap. From Arnaldo Capri, Colipiano Sagrantina di Montefalco, from Damilano, Barolo, Le Cinque Vigne, and from the family of the Frescobaldis, Nipozzano Vecchi Viti 2011. Thank you, Colangelo, for bringing it to us. We're delighted to bring these recommendations to you, our audience, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, I really had a learning experience, and I hope you will too. We're going to be talking to Jay Buxbaum about a subject that, you know, I should know a lot more about this. And of course, I do.
And Jay's a
kosher wine.
And he's a brave man.
Why?
He's a brave man because he has tackled this whole subject with an enormous amount of energy, and he brings. No, just an excellent perspective and a really thorough knowledge of the wines that his company specializes in. Why they're called royal wines, I'm not sure, but there's a connection to a winemaking family called Herzog as well. And here's his whole story. The wine business has had the opportunity over the years since the Romans or the Arabs or whoever it was first started producing this delicious potable beverage. We're going to talk today about a more modern revolution and one that I'm not entirely sure On the Menu knew was going on. But we tripped over a company called the Royal Wine Company, headquartered in various different places, which specializes in kosher wines. We have Jay Buxbaum on the phone with us today.
Buxbaum.
Why on earth did you decide to do this?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm kosher myself, but I worked for a non-kosher wine company for several years, and I had been tasting some of the really wonderful wines that are available to wine consumers and said, you know what? Me as a kosher consumer who only drinks kosher wine wanted to have some of the same. So 27 years ago, I joined the Royal Wine Corporation, who already was at the forefront of bringing a good handful in of wines from Italy and France, and we've expanded from there. And today, there are close to 400 different wines, that most of whom, almost all of whom, I should say, are of decent to magnificent quality table wines across the board.
Can I play dumb here? But before we get much further, and ask you, just for dummies like me, to explain what exactly constitutes or how do you go about certifying wine as kosher?
It's a great question. People think that kosher wines are different than non-kosher wines. The answer is there is no difference between kosher wines and non-kosher wines. The only difference is the oversight by a rabbinic authority. So during the course of the production and handling the machinery during key parts of the production are observant Jewish certifying rabbinic crews that just handle it. So kosher wines and non-kosher wines are made in precisely the same way. Now, having said that, there are about 20 to 25 different ingredients that are used in non-kosher wines sometimes that cannot be used in kosher wines. Some examples are sodium cazenate, which is a dairy byproduct, which is not used in kosher wines, but often not used in non-kosher wines. Gelatin, which is used as a fining agent, which is sometimes used in non-kosher wines, but often never used in non-kosher wines. But those can never be used in kosher wines because they come from non-kosher source material. But in general, I would say that the difference in kosher wines and non-kosher wines is zero in terms of how it's made. It's only the oversight and the handling of it by an observant rabbinic crew.
Now, if we go back 40 or 50 years to the time when I first sampled a kosher wine, kosher wines had a couple of characteristics which were really popular, I guess, among the people who liked them and very unpopular among the people who did not, me being one of them. And that is that kosher wines tended to be very sweet, overpoweringly so, whether they were white or red, which is not typically the taste of a wine connoisseur.
It's interesting to note that Jewry, throughout the millennia, are relatively, well, Jewry in America is relatively new. They only came here around the turn of the last century, and until then they were mostly European. And they would drink and consume, because in Jewish life almost every passage of anything important includes some wine, and they would drink European table wines, which were dry. But when they came to these shores, and it was mostly on the East Coast, through Ellis Island, etc., the only grapes that were available to them were of the Labrusca variety. Now, the Labrusca variety are actually very low in sugar, very high in acid, and they needed sugar to make them palatable. Hence was born the American style of kosher wines, which was the sweet, heavy, extra sugary Concord wines. But in short order, well, I shouldn't say in short order, around the late 70s and till this day, now you have great Bordeaux, including Giscourt, which are now made kosher, Ponte Canet, which are now made kosher, Laurent Perrier, and even Drapier, a whole series of Champagnes and Burgundies and Bordeaux that are made kosher. You have some of the highest rated wines in the Wine Enthusiast and in the Wine Spectator and in all kinds of great magazines, wine magazines that are rated highly kosher by from Israel. Best Buy is in this coming Wine Enthusiast magazine is coming out this month for a Carmel wine and a 93 for a Shiloh wine. And then you have wines from California, not the least of which, of course, are the Herzog wines. We just got Best Buy double golds for our Chenin Blanc, Baron Herzog Chenin Blanc, and several medals for our Russian River Chardonnay and for our Napa Cabernet. So it's only because of the circumstances of Jews in great quantities moving to the Northeast that got them to, they needed wine for bar mitzvahs and weddings and Sabbath, etc. And so they had no choice but to use the local varieties. Now, with modern technology and shipping, observant Jews and frankly non-Jews and non-observant Jews are enjoying these great wines from all over the world.
Tell me this then. You mean that when Jews in America were drinking all this awful stuff like Peter explained to you about this kosher sangria we accidentally bought once, that the rest of the world was enjoying fine wines?
Well, yes, I would say that, yes, the Jews of France were enjoying French Bordeaux that were kosher. And the Jews that lived in Italy were enjoying Italian Chiantis that were made kosher. And the Jews in wherever, South America, probably were enjoying local wines from that area. So, yes, the answer is but we, as Americans, and, of course, also the largest contingent of Jewish population outside of Israel, and even including Israel, still America, had no choice but to, initially at least, only have the grapes available to them, which were the local varieties, and they didn't make great wine, so they had to sweeten them up.
You were on the Royal Wine Company was on something of a mission, but it was a mission to find something that already existed, or did you actually go to winemakers and say, we could really move this if you made it kosher?
I think it's much more of the latter than the former. Yes, we needed to go to winemakers and say to them, look, you're making a great Bordeaux. We've got a large group of individuals that need your Bordeaux, that would love to drink your Bordeaux but can't because it's not kosher. So why don't you make it kosher for us? And actually, it's a famous story about New York Times. I believe it was in the early 70s when David Herzog brought in a one container of three different Bordeaux, and some of the biggest and fanciest wine shops in New York wouldn't even touch it. And then as soon as it came in, the New York Times wrote it up as kosher wine has arrived or something of that nature, and it sold out literally within a week, and then, of course, the rest is history. Now we've got great California wines from the Herzog and Baron Herzog Vineyard Winery, I should say, in Oxnard, California, as well as some of the most magnificent wines on earth are now coming out of Israel.
Yeah, well, it's really not surprising, I guess, because what we might call the Holy Land, if you like to call it that, or Israel and the surrounding areas, this is really the home of the cultivation of the grape to begin with, correct?
You're so on target with that. You know that the Romans, you know, I don't think they call them K rations anymore, but in the Roman times, the Roman fleets were given, everyone was given, instead of K rations, they were given a flagon of wine. And historical digs, etc., have shown that those wines came from Jerusalem.
Okay.
So you're talking about the seat of winemaking. In fact, there is an opinion that the word Chardonnay is actually a conjunctive word coming from Sha'ar Adonai, which means the gate of God, meaning that it originated in Jerusalem. And that grape, which was then transplanted perhaps first to Europe, maybe Italy, and then France, was called that because it originates from the place where it originated, which is the gate of God, which is Jerusalem, where the Holy Temple was. So, the answer is there are presses, and I've seen them with my own eyes, digs of presses that date back for literally 3,000 years to Shiloh area in the Judean Hills and to the Negev, the desert area, in and around Arad. So, yes, you're right on target with that.
But weren't most of the old wines, so you're talking about Romans, I mean, weren't they honey wines?
You know what? You might know better than I, but I would think that no, because maybe the Roman honey wines that were made in Rome or in Europe were honey wines. But in Israel, you have to remember that there was sacrifices in the Holy Temple 3,000 years ago that utilized local wines. It had to be made from grapes. It could not be made from anything but grapes, mm-hmm. by law, by Jewish law, Hebraic law. So
now, Jay, what we were told in Italy, going back to the roots of winemaking in Italy, is that the wines the Romans made were sweet, and the reason that they were made that way and that additional alcohol was added was so that they could preserve the wine until the next harvest. If the Roman sailors you were talking about were drinking wine that had just been produced, then it could have been any kind of wine. Might have been very fine dry red wine like we appreciate today. The issue had to do with making sure that it would last until you could get some more from grapes next year. So it may have been that the same thing was going on. I sort of always pictured Jesus turning water into wine at the wedding in Cana, I think it was, and thinking that what a shame it was that it was Manischewitz. And now we've obviously gone beyond that. Now
where we are now is it's not just wines, it's all kinds of products, because kosher itself is associated with clean, pure.
Right.
And so
right.
Putting that on any label is a boost to sales and trust.
Yeah, there is much to be said about that. I also think it's a simple marketing issue. I mean, and that is that places like California and Chicago and New York and Miami have large Jewish communities that request and require and need kosher products. So when you go into a buyer, whether it's a chocolate bar from Hershey's or a bottle of wine from California, buyers are prone to say, you know what, why not? If you can make it kosher and it's good,
yeah,
and it's high quality, why not make it kosher? So there's a lot of that. Yeah, and you're right, there is a perception, and probably correctly so to some degree, that kosher does mean pure, does mean cleaner, does mean more carefully watched over, at least that.
Now let's talk about some of the wines themselves, because to drunk all the samples yet, we have another one on the table for tonight.
We're working our way through.
We're working our way through, but we had the first one we opened, curiously enough, because we were having fish this particular night, was from Baron Herzog. Now there's a connection between Herzog and the Royal Wine Company.
Yes, the Royal Wine Company is owned, in fact, by the Herzog family.
So we had a Chenin Blanc from Clarksburg, 2013. I think we had it with Turbo, and
It was very interesting. It was a lot like a Vouvray, I thought.
Ah, wonderful. I'm so glad you said that because, of course, Vouvrays are 100% Chenin Blanc, and almost invariably, I think invariably, in fact, by law. It's interesting because Vouvrays will garner anything $12 to $50 or more, depending on the chateau that's making them. Whereas if you call a wine a Chenin Blanc in America, you can't get more than $10 for it. And what's interesting about it is it's such a great glass of wine, especially if it's made correctly with the right acidic and structure, which I believe, and you can, you know, you're the critic, so you tell me, I believe Baron Herzog does have. And this is a consistent, highly rated medal winner year after year after year after year.
Now, here's a message for our listeners generally, because it may be that Ken and Peter are like Jack Spratt and his wife. If you remember, we won't go into that. But I am not opposed to wines that have a slightly sweet edge, like the Vouvray of France. Anne is not fond. She prefers her white wines flinty like Sancerre, rather than full-bodied like Vouvray. But if you're looking for a Chenin Blanc from California, this is a good one. This is Baron Herzog 2013. Now, I know I was the supply that intrigued me most was Barton Nura, which is Italian.
Right.
And the next now we had the Rossa Toscano IGT 2013. And I have a check mark next to that one. And the check mark next to that one really says this is a very solid, straightforward 2013 Sangiovese burst wine.
Great.
And there are some more Bartonuras we haven't hit yet. Two of them I'm intrigued by, but I'm going to have to ask you to describe them. One is a Moscato, and I intend to serve the Moscato tonight with scallops. But I'm going to open a Chardonnay for Anne as well.
I don't think you need to do that.
You want to keep harmony, huh?
Well, I actually want her to try both and see what she thinks. But tell us, because we haven't tried them yet, and we're not going to be able to bring you back on the program. Talk to us about the Bartonura Moscato.
The Bartonura Moscato
and the Malvasia and the Malvasia.
Okay, the Bartonura Moscato is the largest selling Italian wine in the United States, perhaps the world.
You're
in fact, it's approaching 4 million bottles.
Wow.
And it's interesting to note, and this is really the big message here, it's interesting to note that probably upwards of 85 or 90% of the consumers of that particular wine are not Jewish, not kosher, don't even care.
Right.
Yeah, see, that I think is the point that I felt about having you on the show, is that this is exactly what's happening. You're making wines for their own value, and it's, so it's kosher is added value for certain people, but otherwise the wines hold up on their own.
Well, now let's keep on going. And Altoona Hills Balaclava Victoria, a Shiraz from 2012. They got a check mark next to it too.
What I love about the Altoona Hills is that it's absolute typicity for its place and varietal. So you've got a wine that's reasonably priced around $10. I think maybe it might be in Pittsburgh, it might be 11 or 12, and other in New York, it might be 8 or 9, mm-hmm. California, whatever. But it's so typical, and typical is not a bad word in the wine business. I don't know if you agree. But if it's true to its varietal character and to its terroir, then you've done a good job. And I think that's really great. And what's perfect about that particular wine?
Now let's cross the southern hemisphere and go to Chile, and a Valle del Maule Afasi Merlot 2013.
So that
got a check mark too.
So Chile, as you know, started about 15 years ago, became a hot new place to get wine from, and the reason is because it represents great value.
Right.
This is a wine that is. You know, not a California Merlot, but is a Merlot that's about $8 and just really tastes great and soft and round, not very highly structured, so it's not a Saint-Emilion type or Bordeaux kind of Merlot, but really just soft and round, easy drinking, good for lighter red meats and chickens, etc. So there you go with that.
Now, here's an interesting one. Everybody these days around the world seems to be flirting with Pinot Noir. And in Israel, they're doing the same thing. So we have Barkan, B-A-R-K-A-N, Classic 2013 Pinot Noir from the Negev, which is a desert.
This is a really interesting, and I'm so glad you brought specifically that one up, because most people will tell you that Pinot Noir do best in cooler climes. Well, people knowing that Negev is a desert think, well, whoa, how's that possible? This is really hot stuff, right? Well, the answer is the Negev, believe it or not, even during the summertime, gets down to the 40s and 50s at night.
So it has the cold nights like the Russian River in California.
Sorry, all of these grapes are harvested before dawn. Okay, so when they come in, you know, when they're picked and they come into the winery, they're literally cold to the touch. And so it retains that freshness. This is, you know, there's a little store chain called Wegmans. I don't know if you have it.
No, we don't.
New York State, we do.
Oh, really? Okay. So this is one of their biggest selling imported, not one, it was for a time, their biggest selling imported Pinot Noir. Again, not because kosher consumers abound in their stores, but because consumers just love the idea of getting a Pinot Noir at about $10-$12 a bottle.
Now, there's one last one here. We snuck this in, and I want to understand the relationship between Barons Edmund and Benjamin and the people at Chateau Lafite, because they share the same last name, Rothschild.
This is an
Oak Medoc 2012, 60% Merlot, 40% Cabernet Sauvignon. Perhaps one of the jewels of your collection?
I would say it's right up there. For both its pedigree, familially wise, you know, its family pedigree, and also for its absolute quality. This is a wine that's made at Chateau Clark. The Rothschild family that owns Chateau Clark also is an owner, a part owner, a partner in Lafite, and it's made by, who's the famous galloping winemaker in France? I can't remember his name.
I don't know him.
Okay, but this is a classic Medoc, as you mentioned, from, you know, describing the blend of Merlot, Cabernet, and so on, and it's really one of the best wines. Now, the Rothschild family, you know, is an older Jewish family. I'm not sure that all of them are Jewish anymore, but their background is such. And one day, this goes back to 1986, Nadine Rothschild had decided that, you know what, let's do something for the community, especially in France and throughout the world. And we made this little batch in 1986, and it continues to this day. And now there are thousands and thousands of cases made each year, sold out every year. And every year they're just getting better. Michel Roland, that's the winemaker.
Okay, got it.
Michel Roland.
And the interesting thing, here's a masterpiece of trivia for you, a good thing to close the program on. You know how the Rothschild family first became famous?
No.
Because the Prime Minister of England at the time, Benjamin Disraeli, needed £4 million to buy into the Suez Canal.
Oh, really?
And a member of the Rothschild family found in the money overnight.
Wow.
And that's how they became the strength of bankers that they were, and I guess the rest is history. This has been a fascinating conversation, Jay.
We could go on, yeah. Jay. I mean, you have so much material to work with now.
Send us some more, and you can come back on the program. We promise.
Looking forward to it.
And in the meantime, thank you so much.
Oh, sending you wine and coming back on a program.
We want to thank you so much for educating us, for educating our entire worldwide audience to something that they really didn't know. And it's an opportunity for them to shop either budget-wise or otherwise to have a new look at the world of wine. So once again,
yeah,
Royal
I'm
Wine
thrilled.
Company, we thank
I
you.
I feel like I've really learned a lot from you and your event, introducing it to so many people in New York.
Great. Thank you for being there.
Okay.
Jay, you're wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Happy Passover and Easter. And you know what? For those of you who are celebrating Passover, great. Have some of these great wines. And for those of you who are celebrating Easter with your families, you might want to look at some of the wonderful Israeli wines out there that come from the Holy Land, both Christian and Jewish.
Yeah, now, do you have any kind of tips for Passover on your website? Give us the website.
www.royalwines.com.
I bet you have good information. Well, check that out, listeners. And Jay, again, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And for those of you who think that On the Menu is obsessed with wine, we'll show you after the break that we have liberal tastes in spirituous liquors as well. So don't forget to stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
I snuck in spirituous liquors before the break.
Let's translate.
Go ahead.
The email I got from
okay,
these
please
people.
Do.
It says, roses are red, violets are blue, Gavine is the perfect gin for you.
So there.
We're going to be talking to Audrey Fort. And Audrey, I noticed this press release come across my desk, and it was for a gin, Gavine gin, which I guess sounds, it's a play on divine, I would imagine, and also vine meaning because it comes from grapes. But we were surprised that it was produced by a French company. We want to talk to you a little bit about that. First of all, we like the product a lot. Now, we had two expressions. Are there more?
No, actually there are only two expressions, and initially there was just one. So Gavine is, as you were saying, a French gin made in Cognac, southwest of France, and it's the first gin which is made from grape spirit, infused with 10 different botanicals, including the vine flowers. The vine flowers, you know, are these little flowers that blossom a few days in June before turning into grape berries. A lot of people, you know that for the sherry, for instance, you know, you have the sherry blossom, but it's exactly the same, you know, for any fruit. So it's the same also for the grapes. So basically, we make the gin out of the grape spirit instead of the grain traditionally used to produce gin. And then we infuse 10 different botanicals separately. We macerate them, distill them, blend them again together in different proportion, redistill the whole, and then reduce everything down to the correct proof. So as I was saying, we have two different expressions. We have Gavine Floraison, which means blossoming. It's the first one that we created back in 2006. It's the very, it's very floral on the nose and very round on the palate, thanks to the very round and silky grape spirit. And then we have Gavine Nouaison, which is the gray bottle. The other one is the green bottle. So Gavine Nouaison is the more, the spicier and stronger expression of Gavine. So what we did when we blended all the different botanicals, we toned down the flowers and pushed up the more spicy botanicals.
I like that one best.
You prefer that one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're more a traditional gin drinker.
Yeah.
You like gins which are more on the cardamom, on the juniper berries, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's the most important question of all. The person who invented this approach to producing gin, he's a Frenchman. Tell us a little bit about him and his background.
Oh, yeah. So Jean-Sébastien Robiquet was at first, he was an oenologist. So he started working in the vineyard and he has a degree in enology and law. And then, you know, after this first apprenticeship, then he went to work for LVMH, so the Cognac Hennessy. Then he went back to the wine industry, and back in 2001, he created his own company, Eurowinegate. And basically the idea is to promote grapes, because grapes bring nobility. So it's, you know, we use the grapes as the base of all the different spirits that we produce. So it's a blend of innovation in terms of techniques, in terms of product, but also tradition in terms of raw material.
Yeah, I guess it's fair to say that we've interviewed a lot of people who make vodka, not so many people who make gin, and it doesn't seem to matter what you make vodka from. You can start with just about anything, including quinoa, potatoes, who knows what.
Peter, we started actually making vodka, and we made one. We made actually the first grape-based vodka for a big company. And from there, you know, when we decided to create our own portfolio, we wanted to continue this path, but, you know, we wanted to create something a little bit more complex. And this is, you know, that gin, you know, is the first distilled vodka, the first flavored vodka, sorry. So So, you know, from there, then we thought, okay, what kind of botanicals, which is dear to us, which is local, can we use? And this is how we came up with the vine flowers.
Yeah, well, that's an unusual touch. I think, as we talked earlier, it's also unusual that traditionally France is not a gin-drinking public.
No, and it's absolutely true. And still today, you know, French are not so much into gin. French people drink a lot of wine, obviously, champagne, a little bit of beer. The rum category is actually stronger than the gin category. Vodka, just like anywhere else, you know, is the first liqueur sold in France. But actually, you know, when you look into the history of gin, you realize that actually gin was very originally a brandy and a flavored brandy. We did a lot of research, and I think we managed to track the first gin recipe or the first recipe which can be associated with gin. And it was made from a brandy that was distilled on the lees. And it was back in 1495.
Wow.
And it was in southern west of France. So it kind of, we're kind of, you know, coming back to the roots. You may know that the first distillation techniques were developed in Italy. And then, you know, through the monks, then the travels, and the first countries that they reached were actually south of Europe. So that was Spain, Portugal, and France. And what did you have, you know, what kind of raw material did you have over there? That was grapes, not grain. So most of the first distilled spirits were actually made from grapes. And we think that it was also the same with gin. But then with the evolution, gin then switched to grain as it made its way up to Holland and then Britain. But initially we think that grapes, you know, was at the very origin.
Now,
it's really interesting, yeah. Because those of us from Northern Europe would have always believed that gin was invented either in Holland or in England, two slightly different styles.
Yeah.
These were the countries which had the reputation for producing gin, but the French really started it.
Well, I think so. Just like, you know, brandy and cognac, you know, these were really, you know, the first grape-based spirits. And then, you know, when you look at the history of cognac and brandy, then it was imported by the VOC, you know, the Dutch company who was, you know, making business with the rest of the world. So, you know, initially, cognac and brandy went to Holland and then was transformed into something else. So we think that this is the way how gin was created. It went to Holland. And because they didn't have access to grape and to the same distillation, then it turned into Geneva, which was actually, you know, produced initially in Holland and in Belgium and northern France. And then from there, Holland, you know, being in war between the British, and the British won that, so they exported the Geneva. Again, we're not able to reproduce it exactly as it were, so it turned into gin. And because it was bad quality at that time, they added a lot of sugar. So this is how basically the old term gin was created. And then in the mid-19th century, when they finally came up with a good distillation process, you know, the common still, then this is when, you know, the modern gin, as we know it, you know, the London Dry was created. So that's a very shortened version of history.
No, you know your history, don't you, Audrey?
I wanted to ask you another question, since you clearly have done your homework on history. We were talking to someone about cocktails. And you have a cocktail program that you're really playing up with Givine, so we'll have to talk about that too. This person told us that the original spirit that was used in making cocktails was actually cognac. But then was actually cognac, so the first
Sazerac was
the first cocktail called a Sazerac, which was invented in New Orleans in something like about 1850.
Sazerac was invented in New Orleans, but actually the cocktail as a word was actually created a little bit before that and was created in France. So, there are a lot of different theories, you know, about the origin of cocktail, but we think that, well, when I say we, a lot of historians think that the very first cocktails were actually created in France because of, you know, the food culture and so on, but it was very, very quickly imported and developed by the Anglo-Saxon countries. And this is true, you know, as of today. There is only the cocktail notion is only coming back to France, and it's been coming back for the past decade at the latest, whereas, you know, it's so developed in the U.S. or in Great Britain.
Well, now, the point that I was going to make, and what you said was just very interesting, but I was driving towards the fact that apparently during the outbreak of phylloxera, there was a great shortage of healthy grapes in, throughout France, and including in the Cognac region. And as such, Cognac became in very short supply. And as a result, the American cocktail maker, now whether this was true around the world, I'm not sure, you might know, they had to find something else to put in cocktails, and that was American bourbon whiskey or corn-based whiskey. So it was, it's interesting that the Sazerac these days is made with rye whiskey, sometimes with some absinthe, but always with the main spirit being an American whiskey base kind of thing. And it really dated from the period of a shortage. And did that have any effect on the development of gin in France?
No, I don't think so, because France, you know, as I said, was never a gin country.
Anyway, so it didn't matter.
On the contrary, Spain, you know, was already a very big gin country, and the phylloxera did affect, you know, all grape-based spirits. But again, you know, at that time, you know, in the 19th century, gin was already made out of grain. So it didn't really have a lot of effect on the gin category. But it definitely had a lot of consequences on the cognac and all brandies. And this is probably thanks to that, then, you know, you had such a rise, you know, of all the American spirits, and especially about whiskey, most definitely.
Now, one of the things that you emphasized in the information that you sent us is the extent to which you're essentially you're reinventing the cocktail to take advantage of the flavors of the two expressions in combination with other things. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that to make a good cocktail, you have to have a good base spirit. And I don't know, you know, when some people say, oh, this is, you know, this whiskey or this gin, you know, is too good to be mixed in a cocktail, I don't agree. You know, it's just like in food, you know. When you use a good ingredient, some good quality carrots, then you would have a good quality carrot dish. So I think it's exactly the same thing for a cocktail. And as for us, the origin is so different, again, because it's made from grapes instead of grain, and because it's infused, you know, with these very unique vine flowers, that basically we're providing different types of flavors. So basically you're opening up new dimensions to some cocktails. I would say, for instance, you know, if you take a traditional French 75, you know, which is a very basic recipe made from champagne, gin, simple syrup, and lemon. You can try it with a traditional London dry gin, and you can try it with Givine gin, and it will have a different aroma. It will have a different floral expression. And obviously, you know, because origin is made from grape, you can mix it with a lot of different grape-based spirits, but also with wine or champagne, you know, as I was saying. And obviously, you know, the mix of all these other ingredients will create something very special.
Now, how's acceptance in this very finicky U.S. market for cocktails and spirits?
Oh, yes, this is the best market.
I know. I was just sitting here thinking your job must be so much easier pushing cocktails in the United States, because we're all, you know, we're in the midst of a great revival of it anyhow, and the Americans have always loved their cocktails.
Oh, absolutely. And American people have so much cocktail culture, you know, in comparison with some other countries. You're so ahead of the curve. I would say that any American knows the recipe for a Manhattan, for, you know, a well-balanced martini, for a mojito, for which is not the case, you know, in some other countries. So you're really ahead of the curve, which is great, because then, you know, you can continue pushing the boundaries. Once you know the basics, then you can develop further some more innovative recipes. And we've been very, very well welcomed in the U.S.
What's your favorite cocktail?
My favorite cocktail? Ah, that's a good question. So let's see. During summertime, spring summertime, even though, you know, I'm not very seasonal, but there's this one, which is called the Gin Basil Smash, which I really like because anybody can do it. And I'm not a mixologist or a bartender, so I have limited skills into that. I appreciate cocktail, but, you know, it had to be simple for me to be made. So it's very simple. It's Givine gin, basil leaves, lemon juice, and sugar, and you shake everything, you pour it over ice, and that's it. It's very refreshing, it's very aromatic, it's herbal, but it's floral at the same time, it's really, really nice.
Good.
So that would be my go-to during summertime. And otherwise, well, as for now, for the past few months, I've been really into the white Negroni. So, you know, the basic recipe for a Negroni, you know, which is gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. So, you know, we're twisting this recipe a little bit, and I'm using Givine gin, Suze, which is a French Jansan liqueur, and some white vermouth, and equal parts, and that's it. It's very simple, and then poured over ice. It's perfect.
It's funny. I was thinking Negroni in the back of my mind as you were picking your favorite. I thought maybe that would be one of them, and I was right.
Absolutely.
I won my bet with myself because it's easy. I didn't have to win the bet with Anne because I never said it. Now, talk to us about availability across the country and around the world, for that matter, because we have listeners just about everywhere. Where around the United States and where around the world can people lay their hands on Jivine?
Oh, okay. So in the U.S., well, pretty much everywhere. I think that there are just a handful of states where we're not, like Alaska and a few control states, but basically we're in 40-something states. So it's pretty easy to find Jivine, you know, in the best bars and liquor stores. Otherwise, throughout the world, we're very easily found in Europe, Asia, from Australia to China, Japan, Korea, and then Mexico. We're just started in Mexico and Argentina. So I would say, and we're also a little bit in Africa, Nigeria, Morocco, Tunisia. What am I missing here? Well, we're definitely not everywhere, but in most of the countries, I would say.
Yeah, I guess, well, you have to avoid the Muslim countries. Probably. And that market's not going to be good.
Let's not go there with that one.
Okay.
Well, it's been a delight, Audrey, to talk to you. I guess the wonderful thing about the wine and spirits business is it's never too late to invent a new thing. And this has certainly intrigued us. And gin drinkers around the world, it will intrigue you too. So get some and mix away.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Anne and Peter. Thank
you
so much.
You were a delight, Audrey. Really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And there you have it with On the Menu Radio for this week. We'll hope you'll join us again. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.